What's the heart risk of NSAIDs?
A new way of lowering cholesterol.
What about the genetic risk for heart disease?
And what type of graft should one use for heart surgery?
All heart this week? That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed.
The weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins.
Posted on November 18th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Of course, Rick, we are talking about everything from the American Heart Association meeting this week, and all of them are published online first in the New England Journal of Medicine. As we were talking about before we started to record, you said, hey, I think you're going to like this one about the NSAIDs. So why don't we start with that?
This has been an issue because of concerns that some of the newer non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or called NSAIDs, can actually increase the risk of cardiovascular disease. And the ones we're talking about specifically are what's called the COX-2 inhibitors. The one that's currently on the market is celecoxib, also known as Celebrex. And because of this controversy, what these investigators did was they took a large number of individuals, over 24,000, that either had osteoarthritis or rheumatoid arthritis, and they had some increased risk for cardiovascular disease, and they needed treatment with an NSAID. So they randomized them to either celecoxib, naprosyn, or ibuprofen, and they followed them for almost 3 years. And they asked, in these individuals treated with NSAIDs, what was the risk of having cardiovascular death, a heart attack, or stroke, and was it different for celecoxib than the other NSAIDs? And what they discovered was there was no difference among those three. It's about 2.5% of individuals across all three medications experienced a heart attack, stroke, or cardiovascular death. A couple caveats. One is that about 2/3 of the individuals stopped the medication sometime during use. Number two is they used a low dose of the celecoxib. They used about 200 milligrams. So that really doesn't give us any information or reassurance whether higher doses is safe or not with regard to heart disease. And then finally, many of these individuals, most of them, didn't have rheumatoid arthritis. That's an inflammatory condition that really increases your risk of cardiovascular disease. Most of these individuals had osteoarthritis, which is non-inflammatory. But it really doesn't answer the bigger question about higher doses and longer-term use.
We do have, of course, a lot of retrospective historical data with regard to long-term use. And I would also suggest to you that the vast majority of folks out there who are going to be turning to these kind of things are going to have osteo rather than rheumatoid arthritis. So at least I'm reassured by that.
And again, for short-term, low-dose use for that condition, I think that is reassuring. But the longer-term data and the retrospective data you referred to suggests that at higher doses for longer period of time, there's still some concern about it. Unfortunately, this study doesn't allay those fears.
We'll just have to keep on studying it. It's good job security. So let's turn from here then to this issue you raised about if you're going to have bypass surgery in your heart, what vessels should be used in order to accomplish that best?
There are two types of grafts that a surgeon can choose from when doing bypass surgery. One is an arterial graft that is taking an artery inside the chest called the internal thoracic artery and bypassing the blocked vessel, and the other is using veins, usually from the leg. There are two of these internal mammary arteries. So the surgeon, for people that have more than one blockage, can either use one of these and veins or use both of the internal mammary arteries. And the question is the outcome better if you use both of these versus using one and veins? To address this study had over 3,100 patients that had multivessel disease, more than one blockage. They needed two or more bypasses. And they randomized them. All the patients got at least one mammary graft. Half the individuals, they used two, and the other half, they used one mammary and a vein graft. And they followed these individuals for 5 years. And what they determined was there was no benefit to using two mammaries. In fact, there was actually some increased harm. There was an increased risk of either having an infection in the sternum or needing to have the sternum reconstructed. It was about 2 or 3 times more likely to have an infection or to have the sternum reconstructed if you use both mammaries as opposed to using one.
Well, this is really very interesting. Let me just note that the internal thoracic and the mammary are the same vessel because you used them both, and I just want to put that out there so people understand. And that, of course, runs on the inside of the chest on both sides of the sternum. We have looked at data in the past, and this is really interesting to me, that in fact, with regard to outcomes, especially graft patency, that the arteries were better than the veins over the long haul.
Absolutely. That is, at 10 years, if you use an artery graft, about 90% of them remain patent or remain open. With regard to vein grafts, it's usually about 50%. So what this tells us is it really is important to have at least one artery, and that's usually attached to the artery going over the front of the heart called the left anterior descending or the LAD artery. And if you've done that, and that's probably the most important vessel, whether you use an artery or vein on the other ones isn't really as important. Now, this is a 5-year follow-up. The study will go on for at least another 5 years, so it'll be interesting to see whether there is a difference in outcome at 10 years.
Practical study. I like these kinds of things. Let's turn from here then to this one that you described as this genetic risk assessment with regard to cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, this was a fascinating study because we know that there are really at least two things that determine whether you're going to have cardiovascular disease. One is your lifestyle, but there are also genetic risk factors as well. Okay, so let's say you're at a high genetic risk. Does really leading a healthy lifestyle help or not? That's how the authors framed this particular study. They looked at over 55,000 individuals and their genetic risk profile to ascertain, are they at high, medium, or low risk of having cardiovascular disease? And then these same individuals, they looked at four lifestyle things. Did they smoke? Were they obese? Did they have regular physical activity or a healthy diet? And they said if you did three of those four things, then you were leading a healthy lifestyle. Well, the first thing they discovered is these are completely independent risk factors. For individuals that were at highest risk, those genetic risk factors double the risk of having heart disease. If you had a healthy lifestyle, though, it decreased that risk by 50%. That is, it puts you back in the normal range again. People that have a high genetic risk do have some control over the risk of heart disease by having a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, and it really falls onto the heels of the one that we talked about last week with regard to the cardiovascular risk assessment tool, suggesting that, yes, indeed, guess what? Yeah, you might have these certain things that you're going to be carrying around, your genetic profile, but you are in control with regard to modifying that risk.
Absolutely. Whether you're at a high or a medium or low risk, that healthy lifestyle continues to lower your risk in the neighborhood of about 50%. You know, you couldn't choose your parents, but you can choose your lifestyle.
And that's some powerful stuff. Finally, let us turn to this new agent that you, again, selected that you'd like to talk about this week.
I don't very often talk about what are called phase one trials. They're very early trials. But this particular one caught my interest. We now have two specific pathways that we target when we're trying to lower somebody's cholesterol. One is to put them on a statin. The other is this new pathway called PCSK9. The more PCSK9 you have, it lowers your LDL receptor, it lowers your ability to get rid of cholesterol. So the people that are genetically born and have little of this compound are able to get rid of cholesterol and have a much lower cholesterol. And in fact, they're less likely to have cardiovascular disease. We currently on the market have antibodies to this, and those antibodies have to be injected on a weekly or monthly schedule because they're fairly short-acting. And right now the cost of that's fairly expensive. But for people that don't respond to statins or can't tolerate them because of side effects, this is clearly an effective therapy. Using that same pathway, that is the PCSK9 pathway, these investigators developed a compound that actually prevents its manufacture. And using this novel compound, they were able to lower PCSK9, and a single injection had a duration of at least 6 months. They were able to lower this compound by about 80 or 90% and able to lower cholesterol by 50 or 60% with a single injection. And by the way, it had very minimal side effects. Now, this was in a small number of individuals, but the proof of concept is there, and they're going to take it to larger studies.
Very impressive. Clearly, it's nice to have something as an alternative to statins. And I guess I would say, fortunately, most people can tolerate statins. And while we didn't talk about that study this week, the USPSTF, of course, came out saying, hey, you guys, maybe we ought to be looking at moderate risk folks and even those at low risk with regard to statin therapy. So I think it's always wonderful to have an option. It's nice to know that most people can take statins.
It is. And so here's what will be interesting. Let's assume that this is effective and has really minimal or no side effects. One wonders whether this could be the primary preferred therapy rather than statins in the future. And we'll only know that by doing studies in larger numbers of individuals to see, again, A, does it lower cholesterol for a long period of time? Is it free of side effects? And then the hard endpoints are, does it actually lower cardiovascular risk of death and stroke, which we know statins do in high-risk individuals?
Indeed, and of course, the other thing it does is overcome the issue of compliance.
Absolutely. So stay tuned. I'm sure we'll have more to report over the next several years about this particular drug.
Of course, since I'm vested in it, I'm going to talk about the NSAIDs this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.